Coming up on Tech Nation, David Peterson, perhaps best known to you through the alien languages he created, including those for HBO's Game of Thrones. He's here with the art of language invention, from horse lords to dark elves, the words behind world building. Then on Biotech Nation, Merck's Dr. Roy Baynes takes us through their wide-ranging cancer program for their therapeutic Keytruda. And on Bio Issue of the Week with David Ewing Duncan, IT meets biotech. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
I once asked a celebrity chef with an award-winning Southern restaurant, what's the difference between a chef and a cook? And he said, without missing a beat, about $100,000. Well, he had all kinds of amusing responses until he talked about the 1990s craze to put heart healthy next to various food items on the menu. Then he got serious. Turns out nobody ordered the heart healthy items. He said people don't come to restaurants like his for heart healthy food. They come for food they can savor and remember. He finally took heart healthy off the menu, not because he objected to it, but for the simple fact he kept having to throw away good food, and that went straight to the bottom line. But let's not confuse restaurants like his with all kinds of establishments where people eat everyday meals every day. In 2008, San Francisco passed a law requiring chain restaurants to post calorie content right up there on the menu board. Many groans and complaints later, the calories, albeit in small lettering, went up there, and we were all surprised. Who knew that a Whopper was a Whopper? And maybe I won't supersize those fries, come to think of it. Maybe I won't order them at all. This idea was catching on nationally, and several years later, the Affordable Care Act federally mandated calorie labeling in restaurant chains and convenience stores with greater than 20 locations, movie theaters, vending machines, and the like. Well, that was 2010, and there's been one delay after another in getting it enforced. In fact, the FDA has just delayed the implementation again, this time to the end of 2016. So what's the problem? Arguments revolve around adverse economic impact and/or the suggestion that it just doesn't work. Well, the economics are one thing, but we've known it works for quite some time. Back in 2009, the National Bureau of Economic Research, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization, studied months of Starbucks receipts before and after mandatory calorie labeling began in New York City and Seattle, as well as Boston and Philadelphia, which had no labeling laws. It turned out that beverages purchased at Starbucks continued to have the same calorie counts. I guess my Morning Joe is still my Morning Joe. But food calories fell, some 14% actually, and mostly from customers buying fewer food items. So it did work, but economically it's true. To eat less food, we just might buy less of it. But did Starbucks lose money? It turns out that if a Starbucks was within 100 meters of a Dunkin' Donuts, the Starbucks revenues increased by 3%. Looks like the neighborhood caught on to the calories, and Dunkin' Donuts started losing money. In the years since the study, Dunkin' Donuts has increased food choices, including a selection of items under 400 calories. And as you would expect, they've posted their entire nutrition catalog online. I suddenly remembered someone telling me about Dunkin' that it had its own new version of the croissant donut. So I whistled out to DunkinDonuts.com. And out of the hundreds of items listed, the croissant donut was nowhere to be found. the calorie count was not yet available. So at least for a short period here, it's the good old days once again. No news is good news. But the fight against posting calories has got to stop. The price of obesity cannot be weighed against the marginal cost of doing business. You can always think of new ways to conduct business, but each of us only gets one life. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, the art of language invention. From horse lords to dark elves, the words behind world building. I speak with David Peterson, the creator of many alien languages, including Dothraki for HBO's Game of Thrones. Then on Biotech Nation, Merck's cancer program centered around Keytruda. And on Bio Issue of the Week, with David Ewing Duncan, IT meets biotech. David Peterson co-founded the Language Creation Society, and he's the author of The Art of Language Invention. When one of my sons was in grade school, he was asked to choose between learning Spanish and learning French, and he responded immediately. He said, "I choose Klingon." Good choice, bad choice? What do you think?
Well, it probably won't be as useful in California as Spanish will be. But, at the same time, learning any language is a benefit to you, whether it's created or natural. And honestly, the more the better. So you could just say he chose Klingon first. And then after that, can move on to all the many other thousands, like we're all doing.
Well, sometimes you say, well, this language from a movie or from someplace is just a sketch, while others are a complete language.
Yeah, that's true.
Obviously, French and Spanish are complete languages. How about Klingon?
Yeah, Klingon is a full language. Klingon is a full language. It was created by Mark Okrand. So it means that the grammar is complete. It will naturally, no created language will have as many words as a natural language. Natural languages have hundreds of thousands of words, and it takes quite some time to invent that many words. But the idea is that if it had the vocabulary for whatever you want to talk about, you know, the actual, just the words for it, then you could express it because the grammar is complete.
Now, for those of us who are scientists and engineers like myself, what does it mean for the grammar to be complete? I'm actually going back to a time in my early school life where I was standing there and a good sister pointed at me and said, "Well, what do you mean? Is that an adverb or a verb or an noun? What is it?" And I just froze. So when you say to me, is the grammar complete? I'm kind of breaking out in a sweat here, David.
Well, it's not too bad, though, especially if you come to it from like an engineering background or even a programming background where like for a schematic, to be complete, it has to, be, everything, absolutely everything that in order for the structure to work, otherwise it will fail, right? But with a natural language, and the same with a created language if you're creating it, natural language grammars are just endlessly redundant, and they don't necessarily have a solution for every communicative problem, or maybe not an optimal one if you look at it that way. But basically, you can say whatever you want. Sometimes it may be a little hacky. So like, for example, in English, you can say, in addition to saying like, I can't eat Doritos, or I eat Doritos all the time, you can say, I can't not eat Doritos. I mean, it sounds a little hacky, but it's like if you wanted to express specifically that, like you don't have the ability to not eat Doritos when there's a bowl of them there. Why am I doing this product placement? But anyway, you can say it, you can say it. It's just a little hacky. So natural language grammars are that way. And I think so are created language grammars. Sometimes there will be like a billion different ways to say one thing. And sometimes there will be several imperfect ways of saying something else. And that's just the way they are.
Now, of the many languages you've created, of course, we're talking about some very great work on Game of Thrones. Take us from from when you were invited to do that to what you did and how that all worked.
When you're creating a language, it's always going to be different depending on what the purpose is and then what the circumstances are. So the circumstances for Game of Thrones was quite unique. So when I heard about the competition to create the Dothraki language, and that's what it was a competition amongst other language creators. The circumstances were that we had three books written by George R. R. Martin that had Dothraki words and names and some very small amounts of dialogue. For those of us that create languages just for fun, usually we're starting with a blank piece of paper. Here we had some extant material that we knew from the outset did not have any work behind it per se. That is, George R. R. Martin says he didn't work out the language. He just, when he needed something, he put it in. So it was up to us.
Uh-oh, said the engineer.
It raises a bunch of red flags in my mind, too, so I didn't know what I was expecting. But when I saw it, you know, you take down all the words and all the names and all the phrases, and then you look at them. I was delighted to see that, first of all, it was phonologically consistent and coherent. So it looked like every single word came from the same language, which was good. Not an easy thing to do, I should add. So props to George R. R. Martin for that. And second, every place where there was grammar, which is basically when two words come together and have a unique meaning, and it's not just a list, that's grammar. So every single phrase, every single sentence also cohered grammatically, which is, for example, every time there was a noun that was modified by an adjective, the adjective followed the noun. And it did that throughout those first three books that had examples. Similarly, the only phrases that were in the books always had subject, verb, object form, and that was consistent throughout. And you also saw words that were clearly related in some way. So you see the word Dothraki for the people in the language. You see the city Vice Dothrak, just with the K on the end, and you can see that there's a relationship there. And then there was another phrase, Chalaka Dothra Imranha, with this word Dothra in the middle, which means rides and clearly has some sort of an inflection going on. So it was coherent. There was sense there. And I was like, all right, I can work with this. This is fantastic. And so basically the starting point was getting all that down, analyzing it, looking at what the structure there was there, seeing what gaps there were and filling them in.
And so a whole lot of people filled them in, or they had to do the analysis as well and then fill them in?
By a whole lot of people, you mean those who were in the competition?
Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody did.
Was that three people? Or
It started out as about 40, and then we lost people along the way because it was really an intense, brutal, and slightly unfair competition. It was just totally open-ended, do whatever you want. And so it took a lot of stamina. But yeah, everybody made their own analysis. And I'm still continually surprised looking at other people's proposals, which were just outstanding, how they looked at the same material I did and came away with a different impression that was still nevertheless coherent and very interesting. So, I came up with my analysis and that ended up being the canonical analysis because I won the competition, but others were perfectly valid and just as inventive and really interesting. So yeah, we were all doing our own analyses and then built on it from there.
What an interesting insight on language that it can develop in all kinds of ways. But to get that complex, having read your book and having a sense of it now, a small sense of it, if you will, is that it's got to be able to hang together. You've got to hang it on something where you can't develop that many words, that much intent, implicit in what you're saying.
Yeah. And the thing is, if you don't do that, the more tokens that you have, like the more sentences you're exposed to, the more obvious it's going to become that what you're listening to is gibberish. And this goes for any language. If you hear one sentence, one short sentence from one language, you will never be able to know if it's a foreign language that exists on this planet that you don't know, if it's a fully created language, or if it's just gibberish. However, if you start adding in sentences, you hear 4, 5, 6, 10, 12 sentences that are all supposed to be from the same language. Even if you don't know the language at all, you'll be able to tell if it's consistent or not, or if it's just gibberish. And that's just, you know, just a part of being human, I guess, and kind of knowing what languages look, sound, and feel like.
And as you were saying earlier, there's so many, many words in a language. That's backed up by all the grammar you can hang it on.
Yeah. You know?
And that it's far more than the words, or we'd just be memorizing words.
No, exactly. Yeah, no. You have to the grammar is kind of like its own little entity that uses the many, many words. The nice thing for creating a language is that the grammar, that's something that a language creator could conceivably finish. A lexicon is probably not. I mean, a lexicon comprises hundreds of thousands of words for all the natural languages that we speak now. And frankly, you know, we're human and it takes time to create that many words. I mean, the reason that we did it, like ourselves in human history, is because there have been billions of speakers doing it for thousands of years. That's how we got all the words. So it's hard to just do it as one person and come up with all of that.
Now, you've created many languages, but we'll just stick with, is it Dothraki? Is that how you say it?
Dothraki?
Dothraki. Okay. And is there slang in Dothraki? Do you know when you're creating slang?
Sure. Yeah. It's kind of an interesting question when it comes to creating a language, because anytime like you pick up like a dictionary of a language, I don't care what it is, it's kind of a false construct. It's not as if picking up the dictionary of that language is picking up the language. It's also not like if you pick up even a small dictionary of the English language that every single person that speaks English is going to have all those words in their head and they're going to have exactly the same definitions. They're just going to give you an idea of it. But each individual, of course, has their own unique way of speaking English. Like, you know, for example, I always say both with an L. And I just do. Don't make fun of me for it. I don't know why I always have. But when you're creating a language, it's weird because you're kind of creating a standard, which is what you get in a dictionary, is essentially a standard. And a standard is, like I said, a false construct. It's something that doesn't actually exist in any one person, but kind of exists in the aggregate in a way. So you're creating that. But also when doing dialogue, you have to keep in mind, well, who is this speaker? Are they speaking formally? Are they speaking informally? Are they a kid? Are they fully native fluent? Or are they kind of a second language learner? And so you build that in when you're translating the dialogue to make sure that it matches, that it's authentic. But, you know, you just have to do your best.
Now, do the writers come to you for every episode, or how does this work?
Well, yeah, the writers come to me for every episode that needs translation. Sometimes there's no translation required, like the episode Blackwater on season 2 of Game of Thrones all took place in one battle that happened over at King's Landing. So, you know, there were no Dothraki there, so there was no translation that was needed. But anytime they need translation, they come to me. They give it to me in English. I translate it. I record it on MP3, and then I write it down, of course, and I send all of that information back. And then there's usually somebody whose job it is to distribute it to the actors.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is David Peterson. With a background in linguistics, he co-founded the Language Creation Society, and you know him best through his languages, including those created for HBO's Game of Thrones and Showtime's Penny Dreadful. He's here today with the art of language invention. From horse lords to dark elves, the words behind world building. Well, I'm going to stick for a while here with this line of questioning we've been going down, because you can't just send out the English language text. You know, you have to send out how to pronounce it. You have to send out, everyone has to have all of that. And for the first time ever, I became aware of this international phonetic alphabet, which mm-hmm. you use throughout the book. Tell people about that.
Yeah, the International Phonetic Alphabet was developed in the 19th century, and it's a way to transcribe every single sound used in a human language with a consistent symbol. There is bias built into it, so that, for example, if you're an English speaker and you're familiar with our orthography, the International Phonetic Alphabet will make a lot more sense to you than if you're a native speaker of Chinese, who obviously uses a very different orthography. But, you know, that aside, it's the standard now. All right. And so basically there's a symbol for every single different vowel, a symbol for every single different type of consonant. And then there are modifications to, show how each consonant can be pronounced slightly differently. So, for example, ga is different from ka. The latter has aspiration, which, of course, sound engineers know very, very well.
Oh, we're having a good time at NPR today.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and I'll give them another one, too. If you put an apostrophe after the K, you produce something called an injective, which is ka. And that one really gives sound engineers a headache.
Yeah. They're walking around back there right now. I got news for you. Well, I learned so much. First of all, let's just start with all the different parts of your body, not just your mouth, this black box that produces sound. There are many different parts that can produce sound in the human.
Oh, yeah. Now, obviously, not all of them are going to be used in natural languages because I guess it's not convenient. But, you know, you can clap your hands and produce sound that way. You can an interesting demonstration that my phonetics professor did is that you can simulate the sound of a fricative being a sound like s, sh, zh, and so forth, by taking your hand and rubbing it against a table.
Ooh.
Basically the same sound. And then, of course, this is just about spoken languages and sounds that we hear. Naturally, sign languages, while they kind of use sound to an extent, mainly use manual signs, but then also lip shape and different places on the body, of course, and the eyebrows. Eyebrows are very important as well. For example, you distinguish a yes-no question, that is a question that calls for either yes or no as an answer, from a statement simply by where your eyebrows are.
Hey, I'm going to ask you a question
American
here. Are you ready?
Language. Okay.
You got it? You got the left eyebrow goes up? Hey?
Not like
that. You got a question? You got an answer for me?
Not enough? Not like that.
I'm not on to it then. Okay.
That's all right.
I'll
have
to take your word.
For example, here, I'll show you one. This is going to be great for radio.
That's great for radio.
But,
yeah.
You know, eyebrows in a neutral position,
yeah.
You'd say, so that's basically,
wow.
You point to yourself.
Okay.
You point to yourself, point to your chest. That means I. And then you have both of your hands kind of at eyebrow level, and you kind of bring them out a little bit, almost as if you're touching a mortarboard.
Yeah.
And then you bring both of your hands down to the side, and that means I am a teacher.
Wow.
Okay. However, if you raise your eyebrows and do the same thing, that means am I a teacher? So there you go. Same sentence, eyebrows in different places, totally different senses.
Well, my raised left eyebrow is very hurt, but it'll get over it. You never see that on the radio. You never see it. But I think also the different parts that make the sounds that we usually speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, the tongue can be used three different ways.
Oh, billions of different ways. But yeah, so like...
Well, there's three different parts, I guess, to the tongue.
Oh, yeah, right? Yes. If you think about it, just to think about making a K and feel what part of your tongue is touching the roof of your mouth, ka, feel, you know, what part is it, and then make a T, ta, and feel what part of your tongue is touching the roof of your mouth. So it's the tongue tip versus the tongue back. I want you to imagine trying to make a K sound with the tip of your tongue. Try it. See if you can bend it all the way
choked.
Back.
I just choked.
Yeah.
Not so good.
You can do it, but I don't think any language on earth does. It's kind of an inconvenient sound to make. But yeah, and all the different parts that go all the way from your glottis, which is the opening between the lungs and the throat, and your lips, and of course your nasal cavity and your nose also play a role in the production of speech sounds. Each little thing does slightly different little bits to give you slightly different little sounds.
And boy, vowels sure are different than consonants.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, vowels is just such a mess. Consonants are so much neater. There's actually a nice parallel between verbs and vowels and consonants and nouns. Nouns, likewise, are much neater than the verbs systems, which verbs go all over the place and are very nebulous. If you just make a tiny little difference in where your tongue is placed, you can produce two entirely different vowels. And I know this instinctively because the E sound is different in English than it is in Spanish, even though they're basically the same vowel. And I can't even really do it in isolation. I can only do it with a word. So like... see in English is I see something, and see is yes in Spanish. Probably should even do something better like siento. What are some other words that have a nice E sound in Spanish? Mientras, I don't know.
But siento.
Siento. Mm-hmm. Siento. Yeah. And so anyway, so it's like the just it's hard to describe, but the, just as a very slight placement of your tongue, it's not going to change the meaning of the word, say in Spanish, but it will typify you as a non-native speaker, you know, or maybe being from an entirely different region of Spanish speakers, you know, depending on if that vowel is slightly differently, pronounced differently, maybe somewhere in South America versus somewhere in the north of Mexico.
Now, Forbes magazine identified you as an alien culture consultant. And by that, I don't mean an alien culture consultant. I mean alien culture consultant. What do they mean by that?
Well, I'll tell you the origin of that. The term or the title is actually Alien Language and Culture Consultant.
But abbreviated it.
Indeed, they did. But during Defiance.
Defiance is.
Yeah. For Defiance, the show on sci-fi, the science fiction show on sci-fi, the showrunner Kevin Murphy came to me kind of early on and said, hey, you know, we wanted to know, what kind of credit do you want? We don't think that language creator is saying enough of what you do for this show. And Kevin Murphy said, I was thinking like something like, alien language and culture consultant. But what do you think? And I said, actually, that sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty good. And so that became my credit. And it's still my credit on Defiance. And in fact, it got used again for a show that I worked on called Starcrossed on the CW, where I am likewise credited as the alien language and culture consultant.
So, hey, it's a career now. So yeah. you really got to move with the times. Well, I love the title of your book, which seems so simple, The Art of Language Invention. But for me, it was great. Language invention recognizes that language is an invention. It's man-made. It's a technology under my definition of things. And yet a technology can have an art. Where's the art? We've kind of been talking a little about the technology of.
Yeah. And actually, I think that language is easily the greatest human invention ever. I mean, there's so much. We couldn't have done anything without it. I mean, probably, you know, that and the toaster oven, which.
That's up there.
Yeah, I love toaster ovens. But the way I look at it when you're creating a language is there's really two very different aspects of it. One is the creation of the grammar, which requires much more technical skill than any other part of language creation. Again, it's not like creating a computer program. It doesn't need to be perfect. All grammars are kind of imperfect. They're redundant in some places. And
I before E, except after C.
And less than perfect in other places, of course.
I'm speaking with David Peterson, the author of The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind World Building. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, Merck's efforts in cancer focused around the therapeutic Keytruda. And on Bio Issue of the Week with David Ewing Duncan, IT meets biotech. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with David Peterson, who's created numerous languages, including Dothraki, for HBO's Game of Thrones. He's here today with the art of language invention, from horse lords to dark elves, the words behind world building.
All grammars are kind of imperfect. They're redundant in some places. And
I before E, except after C.
And less than perfect in other places, of course. Nevertheless, you are basically solving the problem of communication with the grammar. That is, you have to say a bunch of stuff. You need to convey a certain number of meanings, and the grammar has to be able to do it. But once that's done, then the rest of it is the vast lexicon before you. And the lexicon, in my mind, is really much more art than science. There are definitely some scientific elements that are involved, such as determining the phonotactics of the words, that is exactly how they're pronounced, and what happens when you have compounds. And there's also other issues about how borrowing works and how derivation works and making sure that it functions properly. But as far as the meanings go, it's really up to you to take the entire wealth of human experience or alien experience, if that's who you're creating the language for, and carving it up. There's no one way to do it. And all ways are going to be slightly different. Certainly all languages can say the same thing, but others will say one thing with fewer words than another. Some areas will be more concise, some will be more verbose. Some will have specific words for certain concepts. Others will just have to be able to describe it with a number of words. And as a language creator, it's entirely up to you how you want to do that. And essentially, you're basically writing stories. You're writing stories of the people that came up with these original words and why they came up with them, what the area was like around them, what their lives were like, and what they must have thought of when they came up with these concepts.
I was also struck in sort of the art portion of this, thinking, well, hey, there is a certain potential limitation here. Let's say my character is 15 feet high and just a big guy. So he has a little voice. And then you have a little Yoda kind of guy. What a big voice. It's like, wait a minute. You got to kind of make the languages match, or the sounds rather, match the creatures in some expected way, or not, I guess, if it's sci-fi.
Yeah, well, it depends on the linguistically relevant physiological characteristics of the beings that you're creating languages for. So, just thinking of examples of aliens, the Na'vi from Avatar, the Klingons from Star Trek, most of the aliens that have speaking parts in Defiance. Linguistically, they're all basically human. I mean, they basically have, still have the lungs. Even though Klingons have an extra lung, it still doesn't really affect things. They still have the same
Klingons
larynx.
Klingons have an extra lung, man. I'm going to dine out on that for a while.
They
that
do.
Was really good. Thank
they
you
do.
Much.
But yeah, the larynx is still the same. The tongue is still the same. Even if the teeth look funky, the alveolar ridge is still there. Basically they're working with the same set of sounds that we got. If you're doing something erratically different, then it must match the physiology of those creatures. An example that I use in my book, which is still a wonderful example to bring up all the time, is Dennis Moskowitz's language Rikchik. Now, Rikchik was created for aliens that have a great big globular bulbous head with one gigantic eye, and they have an eyelid, but they don't have mouths or ears or anything like that. And then they got 49 tentacles that kind of dangle down beneath them, and 7 of them are shorter that they use for kind of like hands, even though there are no hands on the end of them, they're just 7 tentacles. And he created a language for them. Obviously, the language has no sounds because they don't have mouths and they don't have ears. They can't even hear the sounds. So there's no point to creating a language with sounds. So what their language is they have those 7 tentacles, and they use the tentacles to form into glyph-like shapes, and those constitute the entire language. Obviously, that's an appropriate language for those people because of their unique physiology. So you have to take that into consideration, but, when it comes to spoken language, you really have to do some radically different stuff to get to some radically different sounds,
And you've created a lot of languages. How many to date, would you say?
I don't know. It's over 30.
Yeah. And you have lots of fans. depending on who watches what series, reads what books, things like that. So at places like Comic-Con and stuff, they come up to you and they start speaking in the language, right?
Yeah, some will. It happens more frequently.
I'm more worried about you.
No, I'm fine.
Do you? Are you able to respond in every language?
Usually what they'll have is like some very introductory phrase, and I'm like, ah, oh, good, yes, I have a response memorized for this. And then it's like they don't have something to come back from that. I'm like, ah, ha, ha, now I can still pretend that I'm fluent. I'm not. I'm not fluent in any of these things. But actually, more often the interaction is online. A lot of interaction on Twitter, on Tumblr, and then just over email. And there are some people that are really, really very good with some of the languages I've created. Like Justin Manfield is just absolutely outstanding at High Valyrian. Intimidatingly so. And so it's like sometimes if he points something out and says, oh, well, shouldn't this be like this? I'm actually kind of sit there thinking, maybe it should be. But then I usually bark at him. No. This is the way I said it was.
I did it exactly that way for a reason. I'm too busy to discuss it.
but it's outstanding. It's outstanding. And I love it. I mean, as language creators, as somebody who was creating languages for 10 years before any of this happened, that's all we want is for somebody to take a look at our languages and say, hey, you know what? That's really cool. You did a good job. And there are so many thousands of language creators that are just doing it for fun and have been for years that would just love the opportunity to have, somebody say that to them. And so that's why, I still try to talk about their languages and share them, because you don't really hear about them. But the best work that's ever been done for created languages has been done by the people in the online community, and just for the love of it.
Now, I took your book and I thought, gee, it's somewhere between sort of a part history book. It's a textbook. It's a how-to manual, which is different. Have I kind of got it in there as to how this book works?
Yeah, and all in like less than 300 pages.
And very easy to read.
Thank goodness. I have to tell you, I reached kind of a quandary. Originally the title of the book was just going to be How to Invent a Language. And when I finished writing the first section, I sent it to my editor, and she said, like, the section I sent her was about 65,000 words long. And she said to me, we wanted the book at its, total to be 72,000 words. And you've done one section out of the four that you planned. So maybe let's have a discussion. So she said in a very nice way, maybe let's have a discussion about what you're doing. So I'm like, oh, brother. So that was kind of if I had a low point, because it was such fun writing the book, if I had a low point, it was then. And I actually had a wonderful discussion with my brother-in-law, Will McPherson, where I just told him, I said, look, this is what happened, because, we're both big literature fans and we read the same stuff. And I said, this is what happened. I'm going to have to cut 40,000 words out of this section at least. And I was like, I just don't know what to do. And he said to me, like, think about the average person picking up this book. What will they want to see? What will they want to read? And I was like, he kind of guided me in like what he thought he would like to see in a book like this. And I said, well, but I can't call it How to Invent a Language anymore, because it's not going to be everything that you need to know. And he said, how about The Art of Language Invention? And I was like,
hey, I only have 7,000 words to write.
It's like, oh, my God, that's brilliant. Because it's like, it doesn't promise, you know everything, but it will tell you about. And it kind of like refocused me and gave me a new direction. And it was really, that was a monumental point for me. And then the rest of the book just flowed from there.
Yeah, there's sort of a completeness to it that says, gee, if I really want to know more about this, I can branch out from here.
Yes.
Now, here's a quick quiz at the end here. Favorite invented language and why?
Oh, gosh, it's really hard to pick one. But it would probably either be Doug Ball's Scara language or Sylvia Sotomayor's Kaylin, though. I almost hate to say that because I think I'm starting to like her new language, Sotomayor, better. but both of those are, Doug, of course, is a very good friend of mine, and he's kind of an Austronesianist at heart like I am. And his language just, it hits so many of my buttons. It's just wonderful. I love it. And Sylvia's always have these just really impressive concepts at the beginning that they're trying to do, that she's trying to do with her languages. And they're executed so brilliantly and so artistically that it's They just blow me away. She's probably one of the best language creators I've ever seen.
Okay, three of your favorite invented words and why?
Oh, brother. I can never come up with some of my favorite words.
But they always say my favorite interviews. They're all my babies.
I know.
Give me one or two.
Let's see. A favorite of mine is always the word for dream in Dothraki, because I liked the etymology of it. It's to dream, it's actually two words. It's thiraride, which means literally, if you look at the etymology, to live a wooden life. But it basically has a story behind it. Wooden came to mean the word for fake, and a dream is called a fake life. And so if you need to dream, then you're living a fake or wooden life.
Cool.
I like that one.
I like that. I like that a lot. Favorite name of a person or two?
Ever or that like I've been involved with?
Doesn't matter to me.
Favorite name of a person. Oh. I've always loved the name Dorian. I don't know why. It's a mode, of course, if you play the guitar or you know, elsewhere in music. And I don't know. It sounds pretty and cool to me. So, yeah, I was actually kind of bummed out that the bad guy in the mask had the name Dorian, because I was like, he's not as cool, you know?
Yeah.
He doesn't deserve the name. Yeah. But, you know, another one, Jareth, who, of course, is the name of the Goblin King in Labyrinth, played by David Bowie. Oh, I would love that for my middle
name.
You
just love sounds. Absolutely. Now, do you have any pets?
Oh, yeah.
Now, what are your pets' names?
My all-black kitty is named Kelly, which,
Your fans are going, Kelly?
Well, it's K-E-L-I, and K-E-L-I actually comes from one of my languages, Kamakawi, where Kelly is the word for tail, because she has this long and lovely tail loves to thwap against hard things. Now, my second kitty is named Roman, dear little Roman. He is named Roman because he came home on the day that the last episode of Starcross, a show I worked on, aired. And the aliens on Starcross have these bizarre kind of tattoo markings on their faces. And if you look at little Roman's face, he has these markings that look just like the main character of Starcross, or the second main character whose name is Roman on the show. He has these markings right next to his eyes, just like little Roman does, so I thought it was an appropriate name for him.
It was a sign. It's a sign. Well, David, thank you so much. And let's see how I'm going to do this. Fonas jek deros ilas nakas jis religo la zariska lovenan in nikula isenolorabuno. That one is, and goodbye. That means all the same in all the languages that you provided us. Thank you so much. My guest today is David Peterson. The book is The Art of Language Invention, From Horse Lords to Dark Elves, The Words Behind Word Building. It's published by Penguin. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, we talk about the wide-ranging cancer program at Merck, centered around their therapeutic Keytruda. And on Bio Issue of the Week with David Ewing Duncan, IT meets biotech. Dr. Roy Baines is the Senior Vice President of Global Clinical Development at Merck. In the cancer arena, Merck is developing a therapeutic strategy to block PD-1. I asked Dr. Baines, what does that mean?
For many years, it's been believed that the body has a natural immune response which prevents cancer from taking hold. And for many years, we have tried different strategies to try and enhance that immune response. Goes back many decades, where indeed initially we tried to vaccinate people with things like BCG. We tried to look at certain cytokines like interferons and interleukins to see if they would help. But in fact, there was a more simple approach underlying all of this. To understand this, we need to just understand a little bit of the mechanisms involved whereby the body recognizes a cancer as foreign. When cancers develop, the genetic makeup of the cancer undergoes what's called mutations. And when that happens, abnormal proteins get produced. Those proteins, when processed, can be seen as foreign and can be seen as what we call antigens. These are the items which actually excite an immune response. Now, normally we believe that that immune response will kill the cell which has that mutation. But the cancer cell is quite devious, and it develops mechanisms to evade that immune detection. One of these involves the production of a protein called PD-L1. And PD-L1 binds to a receptor on the T lymphocyte. This is the cell which actually probably kills the cancer cell. And in that act of binding, it switches off the T cell. So that cell, which
it deactivates.
Deactivates it.
So the
exactly.
T cell's there to kill it, and it says, come on in, and then it goes, now I've tricked you. You can't kill me anymore.
That's exactly right. And what the PD-1 antibody does is it blocks that receptor and does not allow the interaction with this ligand PD-L1.
So you're building the PD-1
antibody
to go after that interaction.
That's correct.
And
prevent it.
Prevent it.
Yeah. And in the process, that off switch, which was essentially activated, gets removed, and essentially the cell gets turned back on. It turns out that that's exactly what happens. So early in the development program, we found in patients who had very far advanced malignancies, who'd failed all treatments, a proportion of those who received a PD-1 antibody actually developed a response and the tumor shrank. And the amazing thing about these responses was that they were very durable. They went on for a long, long period of time. In fact, in the tumors we've studied so far, the vast majority of patients who actually have a response maintain that response. We started off the development program focused on a disease called melanoma. This is a pigmented cancer of the skin, which is the most lethal of the skin cancers. And it has defied, really, therapy for many decades. There have been many treatments tried. Some of them have shown small effect sizes, but in fact, we found that in patients who'd failed all other treatments, a good proportion, almost a third of patients, showed a response to PD-1 antibody. And the vast majority of those were durable. We've expanded the trials program and are now studying over 30 different malignancies. And we have released data thus far in 13 of those. So we see rather remarkable activity in melanoma, in non-small cell lung cancer, in small cell lung cancer, mesothelioma, squamous cell cancer of the head and neck, triple negative breast cancer, bladder cancer, kidney cancer.
With a single drug.
Single drug as monotherapy. We've seen activity in Hodgkin's disease. And a number of other cancers are under study, and additional ones we've also seen activity in. So we have developed a program which is rather broad and rather deep. We're focused on a number of different tumor types. And typically, as is common in drug development, we have looked at the most advanced patients first. And now we're moving proximal in treatment, that is to say, treating earlier lines of treatment. So for example, in melanoma, we are looking at patients who have failed all treatments, second-line treatment patients, first-line treatment patients, and adjuvant patients. Those are patients who've just undergone surgery where you might be looking to try and reduce the risk of actually having a recurrence. Similar story in non-small cell lung cancer. Fortunately, this drug has such a big effect size, we were able to get it approved based upon essentially fairly early phase data in melanoma. And we have additional filings in additional lines of therapy now in melanoma as well as in non-small cell lung cancer. And as I mentioned, we're studying this across a broad array of other cancers.
Now, these people have been through a number of therapies. These people have been through surgeries frequently. Does that interfere with your drug?
you might imagine that if you'd been through a lot of different chemotherapies that you might have eliminated the cell population that you might be looking to activate. But certainly what we have seen in the patients that we have studied, even in the very far advanced, a very striking proportion of patients showed impressive responses and durable responses. The other important aspect is the side effect profile of this agent looks very different from what standard cancer treatments look like. So if you think about patients getting chemotherapy, for example, the oncologist has to deal with all the toxic effects of chemotherapy. So, for example, bone marrow suppression, low white cells putting patients at risk for infection, low platelet counts putting people at risk for bleeding, low red blood cell counts making people anemic, hair falling out, oftentimes significant gastrointestinal toxicity. When you look at the PD-1 antibody approach, the toxicities are very different. In fact, you don't see those cytotoxic-type effects. What you do see is sometimes immune-mediated side effects. So, for example, patients may develop immune-related side effects in the thyroid. They might develop an underactive thyroid or an overactive thyroid, may develop a skin rash, occasionally may develop inflammation of other vital organs. So the oncologist now has to look much more for signs of inflammation rather than for toxicities of chemotherapy. The good news is that the adverse event profile is quite readily managed. So in fact, in most patients, stopping the drug or interrupting the treatment may in fact result in resolution of the immune or inflammation-mediated side effects. If it's very severe, sometimes a course of steroids will help reduce that. In a number of patients who've had this, provided it hasn't been severe, they can actually be re-challenged with the drug. And so it's a very different side effect profile and a very manageable side effect profile.
Well, the idea of giving the body a rest to recover and say, okay, let's go back. That just intuitively makes a lot of sense.
Well, it's philosophically a different approach. Instead of giving something to kill the cancer, you're actually giving something to enable the natural immunity that the body has to actually fight the cancer itself.
It's been approved in malignant melanoma. What is the name of the drug?
The drug's name is Keytruda. That's the name that it's marketed under, and then its generic name is pembrolizumab.
And Keytruda is K-E-Y-T-R-U-D-A.
Correct.
Keytruda. Mm-hmm. Now, will it be called Keytruda as you march through these other cancers?
Yes, that would be the intent. Mm-hmm.
Does it change much when it goes from cancer to cancer?
It is given as an intravenous injection, and it's administered every 3 weeks. And the dose is 2 milligrams per kilogram of active drug. And that is the dose that we're really exploring across all tumor types. So, in fact, the treatment paradigm looks consistent cancer to cancer. And we're going to be working in this space for a long time, exploring both the totality of the monotherapy or single-agent therapy applications, as well as the potential combinations which may show either additive or synergistic activity.
Dr. Roy Baynes is the Senior Vice President for Global Clinical Development at Merck. More information is available on the web at merck.com. And now the bio issue of the week with David Ewing Duncan. David, as you point out, I kind of work two sides of the street here. There's my background in information technology and information systems, and then I'm also heavily involved in genetics and biotech and consumer healthcare. And yet the people who typically work in these two respective fields, they seem like two different kinds of people.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, it's fun talking to you about this because, you inhabit both worlds. But I, as a reporter, spend a lot of time talking to both engineers and biologists. I, tend to talk more to biologists, biomedical people as a biotech reporter. But it struck me over the years that these two groups almost seem to inhabit different planets. So I recently wrote a column called Engineers Are From Mars and Biologists Are From Venus.
Okay, so I'm over on Venus. but I have a lot of friends on Mars, right?
Yes, exactly.
They're friends, right? They're not just...
Oh, yeah. No, these people all get along. This isn't like planetary warfare or anything like that. But the point of this observation is that we have one of the greatest trends in the 21st century, which is this fusion or convergence of IT and biomedicine. I mean, there's been nothing like it. You've got the $3 trillion healthcare industry just in the U.S. alone, and you've obviously got the enormous IT industry. Health IT is a fairly new thing. You know, that's all the apps and devices and, you know, all the different ways to measure. That's about $150 billion industry right now. And then you've got this other trend of consumer health, which is about $700 billion. So I'm just throwing out a lot of numbers here, but this is huge is what I'm trying to say. But it seems to be sort of stalling out on a number of ways, which are curious to me, you know, talking to both the engineers and the biologists. And I've decided that they talk past each other. They come from literally different planets. The engineers come from a place where they design the machines, you know, all they write
big
the code.
On math.
Yeah,
big
right.
On,
and it's yeah. all done exactly as a human, you know, nice ordered little circuitry and lines of code. Whereas the biologists are dealing with a machine, a human body or another organism, you know, that has 3 billion plus years of evolution. And
it's kind of messy.
Yeah, it's messy. We really don't get this machine very well. And partly I see this manifested like a talk that I moderated the other day between Vinod Khosla, you know, the Sun Microsystems co-founder, you know, major engineer in Silicon Valley and investor.
Major venture capitalist.
Right, major venture capitalist. And Dean Ornish, who's, you know, the famous diet doctor, you know, researcher in lifestyle medicine. And I had these two guys on the stage and they said – they made my point. Vinod basically was talking about how the human body is just like a really complicated computer. And, you know, there's systems and pathways that remind him a lot of the early days of the internet. That's exactly, you know, paraphrase what he said. Dean Ornish looks at him and goes, you know, basically this look on his face like, are you crazy? And he went on to say, if, you know, the human body was like an iPhone and, you know, we wouldn't have any trouble figuring it out.
But every iPhone would be different.
Yeah, true.
Everything would be a little different.
You're already getting into the complexity.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
And so, you know, as we're trying to figure out how to make this brave new world of IT and biomedicine convergence, and believe me, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of time, a lot of brilliant people trying to figure this out.
Thanks for coming in, David.
See you next week.
See you next week. David Ewing Duncan is the chief correspondent for Biotech Nation. His biotech blogs can be found at experimentalman.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.